time to catch the beat from Market Street on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Your community radio station is in the heart of the action in downtown Champaign, and Catch the Beat brings highlights of local news, arts, culture, and issues to pay attention to. As always on WEFT, the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Inc., Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. I'm your host, Cope Cumston. I'm pleased to welcome to Catch the Beat Glenn Davies, a painter, teacher, and muralist with a hefty portfolio and reputation. You're based in Urbana, originally from Chicago, but have a strong presence in the art world. As a painter, represented in major galleries, represented in a number of one-man museum shows, and curator of major exhibitions at Krannert Art Museum and elsewhere. And also you have taught art at the University of Illinois and Illinois schools. Welcome, Glenn. I'm honored to have you on Catch the Beat. I got to know you through the back door from your gorgeous mural art around town. So many. The first I think that I noticed was Curtis Orchard, then Dallas, the Courier Cafe, the Pollinatarium, and all over town. You tell me that these projects were commercial for you. They were what you needed to fund your own personal expression. And so that's what I'd like to focus on in our conversation. You have a rich past with both of your parents artists. Your father, Paul Davies, was a commercial artist and illustrator with some wide-ranging and wild-ranging pursuits, including patenting board games, designing party clown centerpieces, and silkscreen prints of illustrations. As a child, you attended many art fairs where he showed, sold, and explored all kinds of art. Your mother made collages out of broken glass and dolls' heads from dried apples. You were surrounded by creativity everywhere and anything when you were growing up. And I was interested to learn from your piece that you were influenced by growing up in Park Forest, Illinois, which was a consciously developed blueprint town designed for the families who moved there after World War II. You were raised with equal awareness of the culture in Chicago and the open woods near your home, so you have deep roots in both worlds. And you began college in 1968 at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. You've always lived a life steeped in art from the classical to the commercial and developed your skills in both, including stints painting circus banners. How would you describe the general trajectory of your life as an artist?
Well, first, thank you for having me. Growing up in Park Forest and in my, some of the things you mentioned had a big influence on me. My father, obviously, he had a studio at home where he worked on his commercial art, and that studio happened to be in my bedroom. So I grew up with the smell of India ink and kneaded erasers and all kinds of probably toxic art supplies and Conti crayons and charcoal pencils and all that sort of thing. So, and then also my school that I went to, just a regular elementary school, had a great focus on art. And we had a separate house, a building that you had to walk out of the regular school building and walk down a path and go to a suburban home that was the art class. And there, my art teacher, John Wild, introduced us to a lot of, he treated us very much as we, like adults. We weren't treated like children. And he had a painting on the wall, a reproduction of an Ivan Albright painting that's in the Art Institute called Into the World, There Came a Soul Named Ida. And I was completely fascinated with that painting and with Ivan Albright and got to see the painting on our trips to Chicago to visit the Art Institute. So from that began a great interest in kind of a theme in artwork that explored the passing of time in life and the looking back on your earlier life and contemplating. It was very melancholy work, but it was a beginning for me. Further on, going to the Art Institute was a great inspiration. In those days, I was exposed to a lot of different art and artists, and our teachers were all professional artists. This also opened many doors for me, friendships, fellow students, and so on and on. Also, my schooling was very interesting in that I became exposed to Chicago's Imagist artist at the time, which was a really emerging in the mid to late 60s. And my painting teacher, the Art Institute school, said that my work reminded her, she thought I would be interested in the artwork of these artists called the Harry Who. Well, I had already accidentally seen a Harry Who show and didn't really know what I was seeing. I had seen it in Hyde Park, at the Hyde Park Arts Center, when I was accompanying my sister to her ballet lesson in the mid to late 60s. But she brought Harry Who comic books to the art class at the Art Institute and showed them to me. And all of the artists had participated in creating these comic art that would go along with each of their shows. Well, I was an avid comic book enthusiast, so this interested me a great deal. And right away, I was kind of hooked on this idea of vernacular art being an inspiration, and cartoon art, and various things that fit right into my plans. I also, being at the Art Institute, saw the doors from the school into the museum, entered into the medieval galleries at that time. And so, coming and going, I was always passing medieval art, and this interested me a great deal. Enough so that I went to the Glore Print and Drawing Study Room at the Art Institute, where you could request the prints and drawings of any of the great masters that they had in the collection. So I could request Albrecht Dürer or Hieronymus Bosch prints, which were actually printed by another Hieronymus Kock, who was a famous printer in Belgium. Bruegel prints, Rembrandt, they would bring an entire box out, set it next to you. They weren't quite as careful back then as they would be today. I don't remember putting on linen gloves or anything, but you could take each piece out, carefully remove the slip sheet, and put it on a stand in front of you, and look at the actual handiwork of these great artists. So I took great advantage of that, and this in turn inspired me to pursue wanting to go to Europe and visit the Ghent altarpiece, which was by Jan van Eyck, considered sort of the early precursor of the use of oil paint, because before that had been mostly egg tempera. He had gone on and created works mostly in oil, and this interested me a great deal. So I went to Europe and was able to spend a lot of time in Belgium and in Florence and Rome absorbing the artwork, and this was in the early 1970s.
And you had a fairly unconventional path. You did not work your way straight through the Art Institute. You went in some dramatically different directions. Talk a little bit about your path in those early years.
I was at the Art Institute for a year and a half full time. Then I dropped out due to the times, the late 60s, the turmoil, the dealing with a lot of, I read too much Nietzsche. So I was searching for some kind, I had not established an art style of any kind. I was mostly had been a photographer. And I dropped out. I got a job as a church janitor. And that was kind of as strangely inspirational because it was my parents' church, my church growing up, very, modern church, modern thinking, United Protestant Church. But the idea of vacuuming the altar area or going behind the altar screen and seeing the Easter baskets and the Christmas tree stored back there and extra crosses and candlestick holders, all this kind of interested me, this idea of the facade. The idea of walking behind a screen of something and seeing the things that supported it from behind. And this became a theme in my work eventually. So from there, I went back to the Art Institute as a student at large and was able to take as many courses as I wanted without paying more than just for one course. So I took painting, but sat in on history of film and learned lithography and etching. And through that also met one of the Chicago Imagist artists who became a lifelong friend, Carl Worsham. And from the experience, Ray Yoshida as well, who was one of the kind of the founder of the Harry Hu movement. He wasn't in the movement, but he was kind of the founder of the Imagist artists. And he became a good friend. And Roger Brown, a well-known Chicago Imagist, was a graduate student at that time. And I would spend time visiting his studio there near the painting studios. So after a couple of years of that, I also then traveled with the circus briefly, painting something called Giant Jungle Rats, which was a site of a sideshow attraction. And this is something I had always wanted to do, be involved in the actual work of the circus, not just as an observer of a show, but to be part of it. And this was a very, very important experience for me because it involved going to a different town every day over maybe a 60-day period of time, all over Illinois and southern Indiana. Just the setting up, the tearing down, the working with the people and the performers and getting to see the shows every day, it was very inspirational. From that experience, I moved to North Carolina and started working for the carnivals in that area and planting trees for the Forestry Service. Eventually came back, got a studio in Champaign, in downtown Champaign, which was kind of a ghost town at that time. The mall had been built and mostly artists were living in the second stories of a lot of the downtown buildings. So I was able to rent a very large space with the idea in mind that I was going to start painting sideshow banners for circuses and carnivals. But if I may segue, I went to work to part-time at a sign painting shop called CU Poster, which was a learning experience far exceeding anything I ever had in actual higher education. Learning from the old-time sign painters how to work large, how to project, how to use your hands to project the size of letters, to change the proportion by putting sticks of charcoal between your fingers at various widths. The skills I learned in painting there helped me then to establish myself as a professional circus carnival show painter because I was mostly doing sign work and decorative work using the kind of tools I learned from there.
And then how did your own practice develop?
Well, from these various experiences and settling into a studio in the downtown area and wanting to work larger and also trying to become a mural painter, because I thought that might be a way that I could combine my own art with just the painting skills I would pick up from working on these various murals. So it was time to finally kind of put it all together. And I started doing series of work, kind of exploring things I had seen in Europe and things I had experienced at the Art Institute. So I started creating these kind of religious figures, or maybe I shouldn't even call them religious figures. They are more like secular figures. I was interested in the mystery plays in the 15th century of the character Everyman, who was depicted as a soul searching for answers and taking a path in life in which you were exposed to good and evil. And this whole idea of creating a kind of fulcrum image, something in the center of a scale of the weighting good and evil, started to become part of my work. I created puppet figures that could be manipulated in a space. And I also just became totally fascinated with this path in life issue and idea in using color, bright color, to tell the story. Because people would often say, well, your work is so brightly colored. Why do you do that? And I didn't really know it was that brightly colored. I just assumed that's how everybody painted. It was kind of following a medieval palette, but a much brighter one. And the purpose was that my paintings started to become like warning signs or yield signs. You know, we take it for granted that they would be bright, they would be yellow, they would be red, and they would tell you to stop look both ways and then proceed with caution. And this is what I tried to tell my story with, this idea that each painting was a place where people could come, pause, and reflect on values in life. They didn't offer answers. They often just offered the question, and people could then answer it in their own way.
I'm really interested to hear you describe it that way, because I've never consciously realized, but that's how I feel about your paintings. Even the painting at the Planetarium, bees and hummingbirds and mailboxes, brings you into a world. And something I've always been impressed by in your work are the mystical elements. I've heard you talk about that a bit, and you have a deep grounding in the magnum mysterium, I would say. What do you have to say about that?
Well, when I was traveling in Europe, I was fortunate enough to visit Bruges, Belgium, where they're famous for possessing a vial that supposedly contains the blood of Christ. And they have every year a festival called the Feast of the Holy Blood, in which they parade it through the streets, but it's also on display in a church called the Chapel of the Holy Blood. So I was able to go stand in line and go up and look at it. And once a year, it supposedly turns back into actual blood. Other times, it's kind of dried up. So it was a fascinating idea for me. I'm not a terribly religious person, but I'm very spiritually grounded. And I guess I'm more fascinated with the belief system and the way people believe. And I believe in belief, I guess I could say. And in visiting then another shrine in New Mexico called Chimayo, El Santuario de Chimayo, there they have a little hole in the ground in this back chapel. It's called the Little Healing Well, El Pocito, the Little Healing Well. And people from miles, hundreds of miles, thousands of miles come to take some of the dirt from this hole and take it back to their home or to use it in some form or another. And I was fascinated in both cases by the tremendous amount of belief that people poured. You found notes and ex votos and retablos that spoke of the personal tragedies and health issues people were dealing with. And I felt that the sacredness of objects was something that really fascinated me, creating mysterious objects that were imbued with kind of a feeling of mystery that you could not quite solve, but that it caused you to keep looking. And again, I wasn't trying to in any way belittle the idea of faith or this, but it seemed to me a wonderful thing that people looked at objects and paintings and found the power within them and to change their life. And I thought this is a kind of an interesting thing to explore.
And I think you have in very different ways throughout your career from the shows that I've seen and the work that I've seen. I am talking to you as part of a series of interviews where I'm asking people whose creative lives I respect a great deal, what have you done to build and maintain a creative life for yourself in your daily life?
Well, it's sort of a thing where I always knew I would be an artist. I didn't prepare myself for anything else. So in my daily life, once I established a studio, I tended to just work daily and keep thinking, keep open to possibilities, open to try new things, explore different mediums. And it seems like one thing would lead to another. So, I mean, where I used to just work on one piece at a time, I began working on more than one thing. I'd be working on drawings, one or two paintings, maybe a sculpture. And even to today, I have right currently, I'm working on a collage and a sculpture and planning on a new painting. I think the variety of things keeps me feeling that I don't fall into some sort of pattern where it's all one thing. One thing leads to another. And just even going out to the thrift stores like I do regularly to look for I don't know what. I go in looking, and sometimes I come out with something that is the germ of a new piece. And it just could be an odd piece of wood or just an object. It's always been a part of me, and especially in the days when I had no money to work with and I was living in downtown Champaign, I would walk through the alleys looking for things thrown out behind stores and then drag them up to the studio and repurpose them. And this was partly from the tradition of the Chicago Imagists, who oftentimes took objects and reconfigured them or repurposed them in some way to make a statement or tell a story.
And you also have very consciously built a rich community of artists in your life. And that I see as a very important part of what has kept you so engaged.
Yes, and I think that's a very important point. I mean, where other people might have just said, well, you've met somebody and wasn't that nice, I guess I was sort of obsessed with, I didn't want to like leave things always on such a basis. I wanted to take the advantage of knowing them further or exploring ways in which I could interconnect with other artists and make a career for myself. I was always, in my early days, I think a little bit driven to make up for lost time because I had gone on the road with circuses and carnivals and kind of lost contact with the art world. So as much as I could, I tried to maintain friendships and relationships with museum curators and different artists that I would meet. In a tradition of Chicago art, many of those associated with the Imagist movement were very importantly would help other artists to make the connections to get further along in their career. So through a friendship with, say, Don Baum, who was had once been the director of the Hyde Park Art Center and had hosted the first Harry Who shows, I met him one time and I thought, well, this is not enough. I don't want to just meet him. It's like the circus thing. I want to know him. I want to be a part of his life. So I invited him to a show I was having in Chicago, and he came and he brought his son, and we've remained in contact and friends over the years until Don passed away, and his son continues to be a friend. And he introduced me to other people, to other experiences, to other shows and artists, and it's all of these things help.
Do you feel that you have made sacrifices to other parts of your life by devoting your main focus to your art?
I do and I don't. I mean, I it's like sometimes you just think that sacrifice is part of it. You don't really think of it as like a necessarily a sacrifice. I think early on I would have been wiser if I had the opportunity to pursue teaching after I got a master's degree instead of going on and trying to find a job where you could have had some sort of security. I chose to go off and travel with the carnival, which was, I don't regret, because the experiences from that gave me so much to work with in my art and just interesting life to observe and stories to tell. But it was a hardship on, say, my relationship with my wife, Sandy, and the time I spent away, be gone for up to 3 months at a time. And actually, I owe almost everything in my career now to my wife, Sandy, because of the sacrifices she made in terms of her keeping a full-time job and offering insurance to me that I would otherwise have not been able to have, being tolerant of and supportive of my career, allowing me to make some of the mistakes and successes that I've made.
What has brought you the most satisfaction?
Well, I guess it's been these friendships and connections and experiences through meeting people. I feel very lucky and sort of blessed. These things leading, one thing leading to another, were very important for me, being accepted into Phyllis Kine Gallery, even though it was for just a few years, and I can't say that I sold much work, but it had been one of my youthful goals, was to be in this gallery with many of these artists who I had admired. And so I sort of pared my expectations down to, okay, if I'm not going to become a name artist that's known everywhere, I at least have been associated with and friends with people that brought a lot of meaning to my life. This eventually has led to a legacy now that has been preserved by the Kohler Foundation through accepting a gift of 180 works of mine and then them distributing it to 15 different art museums, including the John Michael Kohler Art Center and the Illinois State Museum and the Art Institute in Chicago. So that's, for me, was a great thing of satisfaction to know that my papers and all of my archive are now in the hands of the Illinois State Museum and the John Michael Kohler Art Center, and that so much of my work, 50 years of work, is no longer just going to be sitting in a storage room in the basement. Knowing what is an artist going to do with 50 years of work, it keeps you up at night worrying, maybe it'll just go to the thrift store where I've always bought all my other artwork and objects, but now it's more secure.
What about teaching? What part has that played in your life as an artist?
Well, it's been a great thing. For many years, for maybe almost 20 years, I worked with the Illinois Arts Council's Arts and Education program, and that was teaching kids, mostly third grade on through high school, how to paint murals in their own school, in their own community. I have a legacy of work done with student assistants in 100 different places in Illinois, going in, working on these 2-week to 4-week residencies, and learning about these communities, learning about these kids, seeing them every day and working on these murals, and then having a ceremony at the end where you unveil our final product. And that meant a lot to me. I learned a lot from that. And then I was able to luckily get a job at the University of Illinois teaching campus honors students about collage and painting. It was very meaningful for me to be able to expose these young people to the art that had inspired me. I do have a piece of advice for young artists, because I'm often asked that, like, what's it like? It's not all a bed of roses, obviously. And I always say diversify your base, because if you're a painter, try painting houses, try painting apartments, painting bathrooms. This is what I've done even up to just a few years ago. If you're failing in finding work, at least you're still working with paint. You're still working with decorating. I did murals. I do signs. I did teaching. I did curatorship. All of these things together still don't quite make up for not having a real job, but it helps a great deal to be able to find other things to support your interests in your field.
Well, I think that's a wonderful note to close on. And I thank you, Glenn.
I thank you for having me.
That wraps up our time for this week's Catch the Beat. I give a hearty thanks to Glenn Davies, Urbana artist who has traveled a long path in the service of fine art, circus posters, local murals, and teaching. You can see his work at his website, www.glennc.davies, that's glennc.davies.com. You're listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. All episodes of Catch the Beat are archived on the WEFT website at weft.org under Public Affairs. With my thanks to Creative Commons for intro and outro music by Kevin MacLeod. See you next time.